You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. It's Dr. Mike back in the saddle for today. I'd like to welcome everybody to the table, and we do have a very special guest on the line. I love talking about the United States Constitution, and there is no better person to speak about it than Ian Millhiser. He is the Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst at the Center for American Progress and Think Progress. So, Ian, welcome on board. Hello. Oh, I got to put you on the line. Sorry about that.
It's been a while here,
so we're just getting back. Let me go to the call screener right here, and there we go. Ian, how are you?
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. Sorry, that was my bad there. But
oh,
in any case, so it's great to have you back, Ian, and unfortunately, it seems that we're always at the epicenter of all of this craziness here in our home state of Arizona. We had the Senate Bill 1070. I think we spoke about that in the past, and now we had Senate Bill 1062, which was fortunately vetoed by the governor. But before we get into the discussion, tell the listeners from your perspective, what was 1062 all about? And then we could talk more about the pending Supreme Court cases.
Sure thing. So it was a very broad bill. You know, much of the debate about around it focused on its impact that it would have on gay people, because it would enable many businesses that have objections to gay customers potentially to deny them service. But it really was a very broad bill seeking to give all businesses a great deal of room to say, you know what, our owners have this religious belief, so we don't want to follow this law or some other law. You know, potentially it could have undermined not just laws forbidding anti-gay discrimination, if they actually existed in Arizona, but other forms of anti-discrimination law. There's, you know, the way that it was drafted, any law that a business whose owners had religious objections to didn't want to follow, they could claim a religious objection to it.
Yeah, and we were concerned about that, me as a physician, because one of the things they were talking about a while ago was this pharmacist conscience bill. You know, in other words, that if somebody were to go in, I write a prescription out for someone and whatever, it might be birth control, it really doesn't matter what it is, but if the pharmacist had an objection based off of their religious beliefs, they could basically say to the patient, I don't care what your doctor ordered, I'm not going to fill it based on my religious beliefs. So is that what was sort of implicit in this bill? Was it that far-reaching in its scope?
Absolutely. I mean, that's actually a really good transition to what's going on in the Supreme Court right now, because at the same time that Arizona was having this fight over whether or not anti-gay business owners could wrap themselves in the mantle of religion and claim an exemption from anti-discrimination law, you have other employers. There's the Hobby Lobby case in front of the Supreme Court who claim that they should be exempt from birth control laws. There's a federal rule requiring them to provide birth control to their employees. And they say, well, we don't, you have these business owners saying, we don't approve of birth control, so we should be able to impose that view on our employees and not have to comply with this birth control law. So, you know, there's an effort going on many fronts, not just in state legislatures, but also in the Supreme Court, to implement a very sweeping notion of what religious liberty means. And the notion they want to implement means that one person can often impose their religion on another.
And from your perspective, Ian, define what you perceive as religious liberty, because it seems like such a broad term and people kind of just cavalierly toss it about. But and I want you to sort of define it in the context of the Constitution, as the founding fathers sort of understood what religious liberty was supposed to be about.
So actually, the scope of religious liberty, at least under federal law and under Arizona law, is actually broader than what the Constitution provides for. The Constitution says that the government's not allowed to single out people because of their religious faith. So government couldn't pass a law saying, if you're Catholic, you have to do this, but if you're Protestant, you have to do something else. You can't engage in that kind of discrimination, and that's what the Constitution forbids. But there are laws in many states, and there's a federal law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which expands that so that it's a little broader. And what that means, you know, there's a case involving a similar law right now in front of the Supreme Court involving a prisoner who wants to grow a beard because it's part of his faith that he should have a beard at all times. And in cases like that, where one person's religious exercise doesn't hurt anyone Absolutely. That's where we want to have legal protections. The problem with this Hobby Lobby case and the problem with what folks in Arizona wanted to do is that there's been a principle written into the Supreme Court's religious liberty cases for many, many years, saying essentially that my religious liberty stops at your body, that I can't use my religious liberty claims in order to step on your rights or to impose my beliefs on you. Mm-hmm. And that is the wall that this Hobby Lobby case is trying to tear down. It's not just trying to say that corporations can have religious faith, but it's trying to say that not only can corporations have religious faith, but they can then impose that belief by refusing to comply with laws that benefit others.
How do you see the Supreme Court weighing in with these particular cases? Because you got the Hobby Lobby, but you also have the Conestoga Wood Specialties versus Sibelius too, right?
Right, and they're basically the same case. It's the same issue in both cases. It's whether or not corporations can have a religious faith, and it's whether or not religious liberty will be cited so expansively that my religious liberty no longer stops at your body. I was very pessimistic a week or two ago about these cases. I'm actually more optimistic now just because what I think Arizona has done with this fight over the Arizona bill. And again, the issue in the Arizona fight is identical to many of the issues in these two Supreme Court cases. Mm-hmm. I think someone like Justice Kennedy, who normally doesn't care that much about reproductive justice and normally hasn't been too friendly to women making reproductive liberty claims, Justice Kennedy actually does care a lot about gay rights, and if he understands that these cases are also about gay rights, they're also about the question of whether or not business owners can discriminate, I'm at least more optimistic now that the good guys will win here, just because I think that, what happened in Arizona is going to drive something very important home for Justice Kennedy.
Now, talk a little bit, Ian, as well about the – here in Arizona, our governor and a lot of the people who actually ultimately – were sort of opposed to Senate Bill 1062. They often couch their arguments, though, in a business sense. In other words, Right. Well, this is bad for business. This is not good for Arizona. We're going to lose millions and millions and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. But that really kind of irked me because I'm thinking, well, wait a second. Isn't this about a fundamental right, a right of freedom? I mean, the freedom of an individual, a civil right. Maybe you can sort of elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, like, to a certain extent, I'll take my victories where I can get them. Absolutely, it should just be a fundamental rule that you don't discriminate against people because of their race or because they're gay or because they're a woman or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, it is sad that that alone wasn't enough. That said, there are very real economic consequences to a too expansive notion of what some people want to call religious liberty. Mm-hmm. If you live in a state that's viewed as hostile to gay people, some businesses won't want to do business there. And then on top of that, it can actually be a real problem for companies. You know, if I'm Hobby Lobby's competitor and I have to compete with them and they're able to exempt themselves from all these laws because they claim they have their company has a religious belief, that puts me at a competitive disadvantage, and that's not fair. Someone shouldn't be able to get a competitive advantage in the marketplace because of the coincidence of their owner's religious beliefs. There's
right.
also a lot of shareholder activism that can take place. Shareholders can sue companies to try to get them to do things. And the last thing these companies want to deal with is millions of dollars in litigation fighting against company or shareholders who want them to be a Jewish company or a Christian company or a Muslim company or what have you.
Right, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Ian, do you have time to stay on for one more segment?
Sure thing.
Yeah, because what I want to do when we get back here is the other concept that I want to explore with you is this concept not only of religious liberty or religious freedom. They often talked about the Arizona law here, about a sincere religious belief.
Right.
So to me, that's kind of a slippery slope. What defines actually a sincere religious belief? And then I also want to touch upon the fact of, you know, private businesses. I mean, what right do they – how much scope do we ultimately give them to deny services, whether it's gay or blacks or, you know, et cetera? So just think about that, and we'll talk about that when we get back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Dr. Mike Newcomb here, substituting for Tom today. Tom's on vacation. We got Ian Millhiser, and we're talking about the anti-gay bill that got ultimately vetoed here in Arizona. So, Ian, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Absolutely. So, listen, so I want to talk about that so-called, quote-unquote, sincere religious belief, because that's what they were kind of couching into, that you have to have some type of sincere religious belief. And, you know, I was thinking, like, you know, Eric and I could just start a religion right now and say, hey, it's, you know, the religion of Eric and Mike, and then we can say we sincerely believe that, and then start saying, hey, we don't want to, you know, serve gays, we don't want to serve Muslims, etc. What's the threshold for defining what constitutes a sincere or a sincerely held religious belief?
Yeah, I mean, the threshold isn't that high. It doesn't have to be an established faith. Like, I could claim that I worship a stuffed goose, and as long as I honestly, truly believe that that stuffed goose is sacred, then the law will treat that as my religious faith, and whatever tenets flow from that, the law will honor that. I actually don't think that that's the biggest problem, though. The biggest problem isn't that, like, people might have idiosyncratic faith, that people might have beliefs that aren't very common. The biggest problem is, again, that there has historically been this principle that one person's religious liberty stops at another person's rights. And especially what you see going on in the Supreme Court right now is an attempt to tear down that principle. If you tear that down, and then if you also say that corporations aren't just people, but they can be people of faith, then we're living in a world where a lot of laws just become optional.
Wow. See, and we were ridiculing Mitt Romney for saying corporations are people, but maybe he got it wrong. Maybe they're people of faith.
Yeah, corporations, they can be, apparently they can be Catholic now, they can be evangelical now, they can be all kinds of things, at least according to these lawmakers in Arizona and the folks litigating this case in the Supreme Court.
Interesting. Tell our audience also, I read your piece on Think Progress about the Yoder case, the Wisconsin versus Yoder, because I think that kind of really crystallizes what you're talking about with respect to a sincerely held religious belief.
Right. So there's a whole line of cases, you know, Sherbert, Yoder, and Lee are the three cases that you hear people talk about, which built the foundation of much of American religious liberty law. And it also, wrote in this rule that said, I have a religious liberty, but other people have their own religious liberties. Other people have a liberty to be free from me imposing my religious liberty on those. Of those three cases, I think the most important one for current purposes is the Lee case, which says that when a business owner enters into the business sphere, they don't have the rights to ignore the same laws that every other business has to follow, and they don't have the rights to impose their beliefs upon their employees. So these principles I've been discussing are very well established. They go, you know, back many, many decades, and it would be a shock to our nation's system of law if these principles started to be torn down.
Yeah, no doubt about it. But getting back to that Yoder case, because with the Amish family, explain that to the listeners, because I thought that was pretty – that was a real good example of specifically what you're talking about with respect to a sincerely held religious belief and how, you know, that would not really infringe upon anyone else's
right.
liberties.
So the issue there was an Amish family, and they wanted to educate their children in their own way. They didn't want the children to go to public schools. And the court said that was fine. They had a religious liberty to do that. But a crucial part of the court's analysis in the Yoder case is they said that the reason why is because no one's going to be hurt if
right.
the family gets this religious right. You know, the court didn't think the child would be hurt by it, and certainly none of the other students would be hurt if this one kid doesn't show up to school one day. And so, you know, it was the fact that this was something that impacted this one family and didn't have implications for people who don't share their religious belief that the court found very important in that case.
Yeah, no harm, no foul, basically,
right.
in a certain sense. Well, let me ask you one last question here, too. With respect to businesses having sort of the ability to kind of sort of do as they so please, I mean, the case that we all heard about was the gay couple
right.
who were is the wedding, and they wanted to get a wedding cake, and then the business owner disagreed mm-hmm. with their lifestyle, and then he said, you know, well, look, you know, I know it was he or she, but they said, I'm not going to service you. Talk a little bit about that. At what point does a business have a right to say something like that or not have a right?
Well, I mean, a business has plenty of rights to turn people away. I mean, if I show up at a bakery and I want them to sell me hardware, they can turn me away because they don't want to be a hardware store. If I'm in a restaurant and I'm drunk and obnoxious, they can tell me to go away because I'm drunk and obnoxious. But what they can't do is they shouldn't be able to turn people away because of their race, because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation. Because I think we understand that there are certain traits that people have no control over, and you don't get to turn people away. You don't get discriminated against people because of who they are. So no one's saying that businesses don't have a right to turn away customers who are unreasonable or who, you know, make demands that the business shouldn't have to comply with. The rule is you don't get to discriminate against someone because of things that are very personal and things that they have no control whatsoever over.
So would that gay couple in this particular case have legal rights of redress?
In Arizona, actually, no. I mean, this is a hole that needs to be plugged in American law, is that Arizona doesn't have a civil rights law that protects people on the basis of sexual orientation.
Right.
Many states do. The federal government does not. And so it's very important. You know, one law that you'll hear a lot of people talk about is ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would prohibit people from being fired because they're gay. That's actually not illegal at the federal level. But even that doesn't go far enough, because even that doesn't do anything to help out the business or to help out people against the business owner who just doesn't want to serve gay people at his lunch counter.
Right. Do you think ultimately gay individuals will become a protected class?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, protected class can mean a lot of different things. I think we are on the verge of the Constitution, of recognizing that the Constitution forbids government from discriminating against gay people.
Right.
I think that it's a little bit further down the road before Congress is going to pass a law extending that to private business.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Ian, thank you so much for your time on the air, and always enjoy speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, there you have it, Ian Millhiser, and we'll be back with your calls in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and we'll be taking your calls at 1-866-987-THOM. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today. We're going to open up the Freedom Lines right now. Let me give you that number, 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. Anything you guys want to talk about is fair game for me. So let's start off with Gary from KBCS in Seattle, Washington. Gary, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, hi, Dr. Mike. I just want to know why my sincerely held religious belief that marijuana and peyote are like gifts from God to help us deal with this awful life is sneered at and dismissed, but these so-called Christians, who are mainly slave church Baptists, think that we must bow down to their every whim. And I have another question. How the heck do they tell if someone is gay? I mean, you see Jimi Hendrix, being interviewed by Dick Cavett, and he presented as very effeminate, but he was like the most heterosexual guy that has ever been. I mean, he had hundreds of girlfriends, you know? So
sure.
How are you going to tell? You got to wear like a pink triangle or something?
Well, look, it's interesting what you're saying, but, you know, Steve King, you know, Congressman King, did you hear what his new thing is now? He's saying that he thinks even people who are straight are now going to try to pretend to be gay. And again, we don't even know what that means, but they're going to try to pretend to be gay so that they can then go back and discriminate again and file discrimination suits against the businesses. So
they can dress like Liberace or something, eh?
Yeah. Well, look, like you said, who was the real handsome guy? He died of HIV, but he was an actor.
Rock Hudson,
right? I mean, Rock Hudson didn't fit any sort of preconceived characteristics of what some people think are gay. Look, when you're gay, you're born gay. You are. That's who you are. It's not a self-professed behavior, as Representative King said. I mean, you just are who you are. And that's why I was trying to talk to Ian Millhiser about the concept of a protected class, Gary, because, you know, right now under the law, you know, there are certain protected classes, you know, and, you know, race, color, creed, et cetera. But gay is not a protected class. And that's why I ask him, hey, is that coming down the pike here? Because a lot of these religious zealots, like you talked about, are looking for loopholes or trying to codify into law ways to discriminate against gays. And from my perspective, you know, why not just make gays a protected class? And then they can't do any of this malarkey.
Well, what if you're bi, though? Then you're like half protected, or what's going on? I mean, it's sexuality is a continuum. It's very ambiguous.
Well, then let's make heterosexuals a protected class, too. And then that way we got everything covered.
Hey, and don't forget about the peyote question, because I really believe that. That is a sincerely held belief, and it gets no traction.
Well, look, Gary, that's changing. Look, your prayers are being answered. No pun intended here. But, you know, think about it. Look at all the states right now that have medical marijuana. We have medical marijuana here in Arizona, and we also now have states like Colorado and Washington where they've pretty much decriminalized it, right, for civil use.
Yeah, sale, you know, and recreational.
Recreational use. And I think that's going to happen more and more and more. From what I understand in Colorado, the first, you know, few months or 50 weeks that they open this up, the floodgates open as far as revenue coming into the state. And now they're estimating that the state might have by the end of, you know, a full year, close to $1 billion in revenue for just from marijuana alone. So I think once you see that happening, Gary, it's going to go beyond just the religious zealots and the people who sort of want to discriminate against others. I think once there's a compelling economic interest, unfortunately, that's when people's minds ultimately get changed. Not because they're enlightened, but because it has to do with the almighty dollar versus the, you know, the almighty him or himself or herself, or depending on what your religion is. So listen, Gary, but I appreciate the call, and I'm going to get some of the other calls, okay? Thank you, sir. All right, that's Gary from Seattle, Washington. Oh, actually, no. Well, hey, what's he complaining about? I just said he's from Washington. Can he get?
Hey, yeah, he can go around smoking all he wants.
He can smoke all he wants out there. He's in the right state. I just noticed that. All right, 1-866-987-THOM, and let's go next in the queue. Let's go to Fletcher. Fletcher listening on Free Speech TV in Bristol, New Hampshire. Welcome, Fletcher.
Yeah, thanks for letting me on, Mike. Good to hear from you. Thank you so much. I was going to mention the Algonquin Indians. It's a type of language. It consisted of 10 tribes, and they believed in the Great Spirit, which sounds a little more pleasing to the ear to me than God. I shouldn't say that. But anyways, retractus. So there was 10 different tribes, and what I found interesting, a couple of them were names of states, so people could actually believe in the Great Spirit and not even know it if they live in Delaware or Massachusetts. But some of the other tribes, the Arapaho, the Blackfoot, the Cree, the Ojibwe, the Abenaki, the Mi'kmaq, the Sac, Delaware, Massachusetts, and Shawnee. And I just, you know, if I ever get to that point in life where I really need a spiritual help, or how do you explain it, or where do I look to, this Great Spirit. And I think they call him or he, or she, well, he is in all things, and she, Manitou, because that implies a man, but, you know, God help me in a handbasket, but
right.
Let me talk to you about things.
No, but you know what, Fletcher, you bring up an interesting point, because obviously here in Arizona we have a lot of Native Americans, and I know a lot of Native Americans, and I like the way they look at the world, because they look at first and foremost sort of Mother Earth as sort of a god or goddess in and of itself, and they look at nature, and they're just so appreciative of the gift of life, whether it's the spirit, whether it's the wind, whether it's the rain, whether it's water. I mean, they are so thankful for just what Mother Earth is able to produce and give us, and it's not like some of the traditional religions like Christianity. Look, I grew up Catholic, and you know, we were taught that there's some, you know, guy in a white beard sitting in a big throne and somewhere up in the sky, and you know, what a staff, and you got to fear that guy, and I don't really buy into that version of religion, to be honest with you, anymore. I mean, I'm old enough and smart enough to know that that's ridiculous. It's like a cartoon. It's not really to my vision of what a god is. I mean, can there be a god? Can there be a higher intelligence? Can there be a higher energy? Can there be something that transcends who we are and what we, you know, understand this world to be? Absolutely. I mean, think about it. There's no question in my mind. And if you look at just recently, did you hear about the planets that they found, like 700 new planets, the telescope that they have? And we found 700 planets in a year, and it took us, you know, decades and centuries just to find the other 1,000 that existed. The point is this, is that why couldn't there be a higher intelligence or life out there, right? I mean, do you think that we ultimately human beings are it? That's it? That in this vast,
well,
vast universe?
The places he cast his spirit on the waters, we are the waters.
Right, right.
We can accept it if we want to. And also, Cheech and Chong, I hate to interrupt. Can I, brother?
Yes, absolutely.
Cheech and Chong made a heck of a point the other night, you know, about marijuana, as a previous caller. How are people going to explain that they've kept medicine from kids having seizures on up to people dying of cancer and having their freedom of belief and pursuit of happiness and denying them of it and lying to them for 75 years,
right.
How are they going to, how can they look in the mirror? I mean,
well,
slam people in jail. I give up.
Right. But you could sell tobacco, right? You could, that's okay. You could sell nicotine and tobacco and alcohol and all that's fine. You know, that's revered at the altar of Adam Smith and capitalism. But when it comes to natural substances that you can grow like a plant in the ground, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. I agree. There's an incredible amount of hypocrisy regarding all this. But the times are changing, Fletcher. The times are changing state by state by state. Look, that's how it happens. Whether it was the suffrage movement with women, whether it was civil rights, you know, whether it was prohibition, you got to start at least incrementally with one state, then another state, then another state, and eventually, you know, you get the momentum going and the ball rolling, and before you know it, we've brought in a new way of doing things, okay? More freedom and more liberty. All right, I appreciate it, Fletcher. Thank you so much.
Take care, brother.
Okay, you take care. All right, that's Fletcher calling in from Bristol, New Hampshire. That sounds like kind of an interesting place to go to, Eric. I mean, have you ever been to Bristol, New Hampshire?
I have not been to New Hampshire, Mike.
It's got
to
be fun in New Hampshire. I mean, it's such a tiny little state, but I bet you it's so beautiful and picturesque.
Everybody knows everyone.
Quaint. Everybody knows everybody up there. And that's always one of the first primary states, too, that ultimately could decide who becomes the most powerful person in the world. I don't want to say most powerful man, Eric, because as we know,
it could be different this next time.
2016, it could very well be the first female president ever in the history of the United States. And, of course, I'm referring to
Hillary.
Yes. But don't count out Elizabeth Warren, too. Some people are saying,
right,
you know, they want to see Elizabeth Warren run. But I don't think now's her time to run. I'd rather see Hillary run at this particular point. I think she's much better positioned. I think she's done her time, so to speak. You know, has had a great storied career as an activist, as somebody who, you know, has been in politics her whole life. She's obviously been a senator for New York. She's been an ambassador, a secretary of state, and she's been a first lady. I mean, come on, what other qualifications would you want in a president?
But she's a woman, Mike.
Right, right, exactly. And based off our religious beliefs, they should be subservient.
Right.
They should be seen and not heard. And
in the kitchen.
And
barefoot.
In the kitchen. God forbid if a woman ever became president of the United States of America. All right, listen, let me keep the freedom lines going right now at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. Let's see. Next in the queue looks like it's Jane. I assume that's a woman from Round Mountain, California. So, Jane, welcome on board.
Well, yes, it is a woman.
Yes.
Hi, Dr. Newcomb.
Hello.
I'm going to segue a little bit away.
Sure.
And talk about this new medication. It's a long-acting hydrocodone that in my neck of the woods, I live in Northern California, which is usually a pretty relatively liberal area. This is a very conservative area where I live. I'm also a hospice nurse.
Oh, okay.
And the way I understand this this medication is that it's hydrocodone without the acetaminophen, so it's like a Norco or Vicodin.
Right.
And it's long-acting, but people are just going bananas that this is going to cause so many deaths and, you know, on and on and on.
Well, do me a favor, Jane. Hold on, because I want to talk to you about that. I'm also a hospice physician, so we can have some synergy here. And let's talk about that, because it sounds like it's misplaced fear. So you just hold on, Jane, and I'll have you in the queue first when we get back, okay?
Great.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, broadcasting from Phoenix, Arizona, where gays are allowed for the time being. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go back to Jane from Round Mountain, California. We're talking about hospice. We're talking about pain medication. So, Jane, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Newcomb. Yeah, I'm interested to hear your take on this new medication. I believe it's the brand name is Zohydro, but it's a hydrocodone without acetaminophen, and it's long-acting. I don't know what they're using for breakthrough. I'm thinking maybe just perhaps Norco or something like that. But there's such an uproar about it in my area, and I've also, you know, on other news have seen people saying this is just going to be a horrible drug in the streets and it's going to be, people are going to get so addicted and, you know, overdoses, da, da, da. And from my point of view, you know, a lot of our hospice patients do very well on drugs like Norco or Vicodin before their pain gets so severe that we have to move them up to morphine or, you know, hydromorphone.
Right.
But the problem is the acetaminophen level, you get too high and then you've got, you know, liver problems.
Right, right. Well, look. I mean, you bring up some interesting points. First of all, you know, you're probably going to see more and more of that taking away the acetaminophen and sort of teasing them out because, as you said, many people were taking these dual pills, these combination pills that had a narcotic plus an acetaminophen, and obviously they have different ways of affecting pain and inflammation and whatnot. But you're right, you know, with the 3 grams or more of the Tylenol in any given day, you know, you could get into problems with your liver. So that, you know, I think is probably a smart move to do. With respect to them being concerned, why are they concerned about it being a long acting? Because we have so many long acting medications right now, you know, MS-Contin, morphine sulfate, you know, OxyContin controlled release. I mean, it's not like we're creating a new Godzilla or a new monster that isn't already on the market. So what are their concerns? I mean, are they worried about a black market for it? Is that the deal?
I'm not getting any, you know, idea of what they're really concerned about. They're just saying, oh, this is just going to be another street drug. You know, again, it's unfounded criticism because there's no data. I mean,
right.
Number one, I think I get really annoyed because where I live in Shasta County, mm-hmm. and it is so conservative, but
right.
there's such a need for good, you know, pain control.
Absolutely.
Going back to medical marijuana, they're trying to enforce a law that there is no outside growing of marijuana, medical marijuana at all, only indoor grows that'll be tightly controlled. So it's to me, you know, being an advocate for those patients with, you know, with severe pain, not just hospice patients.
Sure.
It's like the 99% versus the 1%. Yeah, if you've got, you know, 800 acres, maybe you can grow some marijuana, you know, for medical use.
Yeah.
But if you just have, you know, a backyard, you can't afford to build a, you know, a structure that's going to house the marijuana. But I don't want to get so much into the marijuana thing. I was just wondering if you knew of any reason why this
would be
worse than methadone. To me, is the most deadly.
Yeah. Look. The bottom line is, if these people really claim to be for freedom and liberty, then what about freedom to be free of pain, you know, the liberty to not be suffering? I mean, you really got to look at it from that perspective. I mean, if you're a hospice nurse, Jane, I'm a hospice physician, and I deal with this every single day where I have to have patients on, you know, both a short-acting immediate-release form of a narcotic and then a long-acting one. And just so the listeners understand is that pain can happen at any time, any place, and it's sometimes very difficult to control. So what we do as healthcare providers is we have sort of a two-prong approach. We like to give people what's called a long-acting medicine, as Jane had alluded to, that basically sort of goes into your blood at a steady state little by little by little, but it'll last for, say, 12 hours, okay? So you don't get as high a concentration in your blood immediately, but it's just kind of there in the background trying to maintain the pain. But then if you have spikes in that pain, okay, in other words, if you have the long-acting medicine but now you're in exquisite pain, that long-acting medicine is not going to do much. So then we give what's called immediate release pain medication, and that usually works very quickly, you know, within minutes, let's put it that way. And then what we do is, based off of how you respond to the short acting, we can up the dose of the long acting so that you get these steady state levels and ultimately you're out of pain. So why somebody in these conservative individuals, Jane, would be against, you know, cancer patients or people who are dying or terminally ill, against them getting the medications that they need to keep them out of pain and suffering is beyond me. I mean, in one vein, they're saying, you know, they don't believe in sort of euthanasia, but in the second sense, it's what they're saying here is that, hey, and we don't want them to have adequate pain control either. That to me seems a little bit callous. But listen, Jane, I appreciate your insight into this. I'm going to get to some of the other callers, so thank you for calling in today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for the work you do. It's a very noble thing to be a hospice nurse, so thank you.
Back at you.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. Yes, actually, it's a great field, hospice, and I'll tell you, if people don't know about it, you should check out hospice. I do a lot of work here in the Valley with Hospice of Arizona, and the hospice community does great, incredible work to help people at that very difficult time, the time when we're all exiting this world. You know, Eric, it's a gift to be here. It's a blessing to be here, but eventually we all have to sort of meet our maker at some point or another. And
so you kind of help ease them on out.
I help them ease on down the road.
There you go.
Absolutely. All right, let's get back to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. Let's see who's next in the queue, who's been holding the longest. Let's go to another Jane. How about another Jane, Eric?
Okay, we're on a Jane roll.
Yes, and it's the second Jane from Free Speech TV as well. So let's.
You mean she's watching Free Speech?
Yes, Free Speech. So, Jane, welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Is this Jane? This is Jane from Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Yes, Jane. How are you? And interestingly enough, our screener put it as Altoona, A-L, and then a new word, T-U-N-A. Now, I'm from Pennsylvania. I know it's A-L-T-O-O-N-A, but, you know.
Right. Well,
yes.
Look, those things happen.
It happens.
I'm going to start a new sincere religion. And one of the strongest aspects of my sincere religion is that I cannot give tax money to corporations or individuals who have a net profit of over $1 million a year.
All right. Well, Jane, we're going to have to go right now because we've got to go to the break. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back, my friends. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in here for Tom today. Hour number two, we have another special guest on the line. Then we'll get to the calls a little bit after that. So for those of you holding on the Freedom Lines, be patient. The doc will definitely get to you. But we have currently, right now, on the line, Paul Shapiro. He is the Vice President for Farm Animal Protection and the Humane Society of the United States. What we wanted to talk about today was actually whistleblowers, and we'll get into the particulars here in a second. So, Paul, welcome to the table.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Mike.
Well, it's great to have you here. Well, listen, you know, animals are near and dear to my heart. You know, my wife, when we got married, she said she never wanted to have children and she never wanted any pets. And now we have two kids and six dogs. So she's very much active, my wife, in the Beagle Project out here in Arizona, the Beagle Rescue Project.
Yeah, because, that's fantastic.
So, and we just recently, not too long ago, sort of we fostered this 13-year-old Beagle. But unfortunately, the owner had, I think, some terminal cancer, and she ended up dying. Since he was already part of the crew, we kept him. So
good for you. Good for you. That's great.
But there's not a lot of room in my bed anymore to stretch out. But
I was going to say, you might have a false advertising claim after the no kids and no pets assertion at the beginning there.
Right. Absolutely. So listen, Paul, tell us what's happening with these anti-whistleblower bills that are seeming to sprout up everywhere across the country, and particularly with the agricultural.
Sure. In recent years, animal welfare groups like the Humane Society of the United States have been conducting whistleblowing exposés at factory farms, slaughter plants, and the results of these investigations have been the exposure of hideous animal cruelty, food safety nightmares, problematic conditions for workers, environmental degradation, and more. And the meat industry's response to all of this, they've seen the meat recalls that have ensued. They've seen the slaughter plant shutdowns. They've seen the criminal animal cruelty convictions And the meat industry's response has not been to try to clean up its act. It's not been to try to prevent the types of abuses we're uncovering from occurring. Rather, it's simply to prevent Americans from finding out about these abuses in the first place by introducing these ag-gag whistleblower suppression bills that are intended to blow the whistle on the whistleblower by making it a crime merely to take a video of what happens inside of a factory farm or slaughter plant. It's un-American, it's unconstitutional, and it shows just how desperate the meat industry is to hide what it's doing from the American public.
Wow, it sounds like Upton Sinclair in the jungle all over again.
Indeed it is. You know, if you look, that was about a century ago when Sinclair published The Jungle, looking at problems in the meat industry, both from the workers' perspective and from the farm animals' perspective, and that led to new federal legislation aimed at reforming this industry. Today, if Sinclair were to go about his so-called muckraking journalism, the meat industry would try to have him locked up and thrown in prison. And indeed, in states like Iowa and Utah and now Idaho, they're succeeding in passing these ag gag laws that criminalize the mere act of whistleblowing on a factory farm or in a slaughter plant.
Now, Paul, how will that comport with federal law? I mean, can states go about just doing that willy-nilly? I mean, does it conflict at all with federal law?
So in 2012, Utah passed its ag gag law that requires basically anybody who takes a photo or video of an agricultural operation without the owner's permission is guilty of a crime. That law has now been challenged in court, and that case is pending. It's being challenged on constitutional grounds.
Right.
We'll see. I think the arguments are very strong that there are serious constitutional questions associated with banning photography. And this isn't just hypothetical. A woman in Utah last year named Amy Meyer was on a public sidewalk, and she saw outside of a slaughter plant across the street, they were dragging a downed cow, a cow who was too injured even to stand and walk to her own slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And they were dragging her with chains throughout the parking lot. She pulled out her iPhone, and she started videotaping. And the police did make an arrest in the case, not of the animal abusers, but of against Ms. Meyer for filming the abuse. Now, there was such a national outcry in this case that they ended up dropping the charges against her, but the law still remains on the books. It's illegal to take video of animal cruelty on a factory farm or in a slaughter plant in the states that have passed these types of laws.
No, that's unconscionable. Listen, when I was looking about what do these anti-whistleblower bills do, in one particular case you talked about suppressing investigations into cruel horse soaring. What is that? I never really heard of that term, horse soaring.
In Tennessee, there's an entire industry called the walking horse industry, where basically they exaggerate the gait of the horse so that they have extremely high-stepping horses that they use for various types of shows. And the way they get the horses to take these very bizarre high steps is they torture them. When it's called soaring, where they make the horses, the bottoms of their legs very sore by applying caustic chemicals, by putting chains around them, sometimes even lacerating them. They put the horses on essentially what are like stilts to make them, make them stand very high. And this is an unconscionable practice. It's cruel. It's inhumane. And an HSUS investigation into the Tennessee walking horse industry found that the practice is prevalent. In response to our investigation, the Tennessee legislature actually put forth a bill to ban these investigations, and the bill was ultimately vetoed by the governor.
Wow. That's just insane. So what are we seeing then with respect? Because I know a lot of state newspapers and editorial boards have opined against these ag-gag bills. And is it being effective? Is it heightening the awareness of the public such that the outcry is strong enough to get the state legislatures to reconsider?
In most cases, yes. So in 2013, there were 11 states that introduced these type of whistleblower suppression bills, and in all 11 states, those bills were defeated. However, in 2013, while most of the ag gag bills have been defeated, in Idaho, just this past week, they did enact it. The governor signed it into law. It now is a crime in Idaho to take a photo or video of an agricultural operation without the owner's permission. So the media coverage that has surrounded this issue has been overwhelmingly negative for the meat industry. In fact, the pork industry's trade group did its own survey of all the media coverage, and they found that 99% of it was negative for them. But the industry also knows that undercover exposés also produce negative publicity for them when they show that these factory farms are brutalizing animals. I mean, locking them in cages so small they can't even turn around for their entire lives. These are that's a standard industry practice. It's not an anomaly or an exception. It's a standard industry practice in the pork industry. So they want to keep Americans in the dark. They're grasping at straws to do it because their record of rampant animal abuse is so sordid. They just want to close the curtains and make sure that people never find out about how abusive the meat industry is to animals.
Yeah, no doubt about it. What would be some of the things you'd like to see happen, Paul, as part of the Humane Society of the United States of America? What would you like to see with respect to the meat industry? What would be your ideal world?
So the meat industry, instead of trying to pass laws to ban photography inside of slaughter plants and factory farms, should be working to pass laws to reform itself so that these types of practices where pigs are locked inside of crates so small they can barely move their whole lives, or chickens are locked inside of cages in the egg industry where they can't even spread their wings for their entire lives, or chickens and turkeys raised for meat who are bred to grow so obese so fast that many of them can't even walk more than a few pitiful steps before they collapse under their own bulk. These are the type of cruelties in the industry that the industry should be seeking to root out. Instead, they are standard industry practice in the meat and the egg industries. And these are industries that have shown that they're just averse to reform. They want to keep the status quo.
No, no doubt about it. Sounds like it's all about the almighty dollar to them. All right, listen, Paul, we appreciate your time on the air. Again, it's Paul Shapiro, Vice President of the Farm Animal Protection, Humane Society of the U.S., and the website is www.humanesociety.org. Paul, thank you for all the work you do, and keep it up.
It's an honor, Dr. Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, listen, when we get back, your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to get right to the Freedom Lines here at 1-866-987-THOM. And very interesting interview there, Eric, with Paul Shapiro. I mean, that's horrible, that crap that goes on with these animals and the abuse and these cages where they can't even spread their wings or move, and they're like that for their whole lives.
You know, and people who hear these things and are disgusted by it still eat the meat.
I know. It's so horrible.
We were just talking about that.
I know. I mean, we were talking about it off air. I mean, I'm trying to migrate my diet more towards, you know, vegetables and fruits and fish somewhat. I mean, at least the fish can swim around, right? Unless the farm fish. Right, then
yeah,
they're probably,
they have a lot of farm fish that they sell.
They're not, you know, well, wild caught fish will have more freedom and liberty, right?
Right.
Yeah, but it's
free range fish.
Yeah, free range fish. But I guess we want to suppress it, though. I mean, that's what the Humane Society does. It's out there to try to heighten the awareness and let people know about the cruel practices that are occurring. But I mean, if you do like to eat meat, you don't want to hear it, right? I mean, you'd rather just as not hear.
Just ignore it.
Yeah, ignore it and kind of wish it away. But look, I'm glad they're doing the work that they're doing. And I'm an animal lover. I absolutely love animals. And I think that how we treat animals, Eric, really reflects on who we are as a human species and as a society. And if you treat your animals poorly, then that doesn't really bode well for the society as a whole, I would think.
I agree too.
All right. Well, listen, let's get back to the Freedom Lines. Let's go next to Derek, who's listening on WCPT in Los Angeles, California. Welcome, Derek.
Hey there. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
I was just going to mention something what you were talking about a little earlier about the fact that they want to be able to discriminate on religious beliefs against people going into their business.
Correct.
And I thought there's a good way to turn around on them and say, fine, I'm a business owner. I believe in the Christian, where the Jesus was a liberal. He, you know, cared about everybody. And the fact that you're a conservative Republican who don't like gays, don't like this, don't like that, I don't have to serve you and tell the conservatives, fine, you're not going to get served at my business now.
Well,
they like it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point, Derek, because that's kind of what happened here in Arizona when 1062 got passed by the House and the Senate and went to the governor's desk for signature, the Chamber of Commerce, the business community, those were the ones who really started to stand up, even actually Republican conservative businesses, because they knew precisely what you just said is that, guess what, whether you like them or not, the gay individual or the gay couple or the gay family, they're consumers, and that they can spend money and they can spend dollars. That if you pass this bill, you're going to cut out, you know, a pretty substantial part of your business, you know, and they didn't want to do that. So they understood exactly what you were talking about, Derek, is that they didn't want to go down that road. And I think that's ultimately who put the most pressure on the governor, was the conservative Republican business community who thought it was going to be bad for business. They didn't want it vetoed because it was wrong, because it was infringing on somebody's rights and their liberties and freedom as a human being. They wanted it to be vetoed because it would hurt them in the pocketbook. Eric, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say it was all about the bucks.
Yeah, it was all about the bucks. So, all right, listen, Derek, I appreciate it. Good insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's Derek calling from Los Angeles, California. All right, that opens up another Freedom Line here on the Tom Hartman program. So anything you guys want to talk about is fair game with the doc today. Just give us a shout out. Let's see who's next on the queue. Let's try Dustin, also on Free Speech TV, listening from Batesville, Arkansas. Dustin, what's on your mind today?
Not much. I was just wondering, how come nobody's talking about Roseanne running for president? Everybody's talking about Hillary and downgrading her.
Right. I assume you're talking about Roseanne Barr.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? You think Roseanne would be a good steward of the government? And I mean, she didn't really do that hot when it came to singing the national anthem. I think that would be one of the first things I would think, that if she were to run, that her competitors will be playing that tape over and over and over again.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sir? My phone died. I don't know. I don't think she takes any crap, and she'll give them a run for her money. I think she'll start things up is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, what do you think about Hillary?
She's all right, I guess, but everybody's beating up on her for, you know, this and that and whatever. I just think she'll get a lot of mud thrown at her.
Yeah, but then wouldn't you be happy from Arkansas? I mean, you'll have another president. You had Bill, Billy Boy, and now you'd have Hillary.
I guess so, but it don't really matter where they're from. It's just what they do and what they're able to get done.
Right, no doubt about it. All right, well, we'll see what happens. We'll see if Roseanne Barr throws her hat into the ring. I know I think she was actually looking to get the Libertarian nomination at some point. I know we're joking about that, but wasn't she trying to get the Libertarian nomination or some type of sort of breakout political party? She was trying to become their standard bearer.
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure.
I'm not joking about this. I think that she did, you know, consider running and getting that party's nomination. Eric, you can either Google it or get the interns working on it.
I'm looking at it right now.
All right, listen, appreciate the time. Thank you, Dustin.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, that's Dustin there weighing in with his particular thoughts. But, hey, we'll see what happens. I think, Eric, I really do think that Hillary's got a tremendous opportunity and chance to win in 2016 if she so chooses to run. Now, I know right now that's the game you play in politics. Look, you know, I'm not going to mention anything right now. Well, you know, we'll just play it by ear. But, you know, by all accounts, I think she's definitely going to be throwing her hat into the ring. What do you think?
I don't know, but I can see here. I'm not sure what party, because it doesn't say, but according to HuffPost, it says she finished fifth in the general election.
All right, so she did run, and she just didn't get the nomination.
Right.
So that's not really good news for Dustin. I mean, if she's in a fringe sort of outside the mainstream political party and she comes in fifth in that, it's going to be hard to kind of get mainstream America to vote for you.
It says she got 48,797 votes.
That's not too bad. That's not too bad.
She finished right behind Green Party candidate Jill Stein.
Oh, well, Jill Stein's a formidable candidate. I mean, I can see why that
The Green
happened.
Party always is.
Yes, absolutely. All right. In any case, we still got a lot of people on the line. We're going to go to a quick break here, but we still got Ian on the line from Manhattan. We got Armin from Florida. We got Mike from Arizona here. We also got Don calling from Washington. We got Dennis from Michigan and Tana from California. People from all across this great nation calling in to the Tom Hartman program. What an audience. Okay, 1-866-987-THOM is the number for the Freedom Lines. 1-866-987-8466. Back in a moment with your calls.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, the Valley's Progressive Talk, Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in. Okay, let's get to the Freedom Lines. Eric here, and hey, did you hear the other thing, too, I saw in the news today? Did you ever take the SATs when you were in high school?
Of course.
Yeah, they're like, they change it. It used to have two sections. It used to have math and then verbal.
Right.
And then it was like 800 each section, and then they changed it to three sections, and then it's a writing section now that, you know, you would get scored on a 1 to 6. Well, there's big changes afoot now. They're going back to the old way of doing it, which is just two sections, but they're also now saying, because of a lot of people feeling that it's culturally biased, that they're going to try to offer more opportunities to minorities to take courses, and they're partnering up with this Khan Academy. If you've never checked out the Khan Academy, I've checked it out. It's a not-for-profit educational website, started around 2006. They do phenomenal, phenomenal work. And you just, if you Google it, Khan Academy, you can learn practically anything on this website, you know, anything from math to science to history, an incredible, incredible site. So they're partnering up with the Khan Academy to
K-H-A-N.
K-H-A-N, exactly. And they want to give opportunities to lower socioeconomic kids that they have the availability to take these prep courses, because, you know, there's lots of prep courses out there. I used to teach actually for a company called Princeton Review, and it was actually just starting out. When I was at NYU, I was, I think, probably a junior. This was probably around 1985 probably is when it was. And they just started out as a test prep company, and now they're nationwide, and it's probably a hundreds of millions of dollars of value, the company. But it's very expensive. Like, if you want to actually take the course for the Princeton Review, and I know they have some financial aid, but I think it's maybe about $500 or something like that. And that's a lot of money for a kid if they want to take a test prep course.
Right.
$500. So now what they're going to do is the College Board is going to team up with the Khan Academy, and they're going to offer these free online courses to kids in that socioeconomic background demographic, so that they too can have opportunity. And then the other thing they're going to do, Eric, too, which I'm sure you're very happy to hear this, is that the words now, the vocabulary portion of it, they will only be using words that you're supposed to hear in college. So it won't be just kind of the words that you see on the SAT and they'll never show up again in your life. So they're going to try to make it a little bit more mainstream. So, you know, you might see like words like LOL or, you know, things like that. OMG, things, you know, all the acronyms.
Right.
Yes, no doubt about it.
Is that what we've come to in this country?
Yes.
Talking with initials?
With just
acronyms.
Initials, just little acronyms. So for all of you who have gone through the ritual of taking the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, there it is. And you could do better on it if you get the tutoring, Eric. I remember when I took the SAT, well, we took the pre-SATs first. They're called the PSATs, P-S-A-T. And I think I took it as a freshman. And I had no clue what the test was about. I mean, you know, I'm just filling in bubbles here or there and didn't do so hot on that first test. But after that little wake-up call, I ended up getting this book called the Barron's SAT book, and it was like a big, thick book, you know, hundreds of pages, and they had actually a list of like 3,000 words or something. I think it was 2,500 words then. It was like the 2,500 most commonly seen SAT words, and I said, you know what I'm going to do this summer? I'm going to actually take those 2,500 words, because there was about 100 days in the summer, and I said, every day I'm going to learn 25 of those words.
And then the next day you forgot the previous day's 25.
No, because what I did, it's a good question. What I did was when I learned the 25, before I would go to the next, say today I did 25,
yes,
right? Now tomorrow's my second 25. I would not go through and start the next 25
until
I reviewed the other 25. And then if I missed one or two or whatever, I would put a little dot next to it. And I know that's a word that I was a little weak on.
So there was one day you actually reviewed 2,500 words?
Well, no. What I did was I had the dots. So I, you know, each day if there was two, then I know that's two that I didn't remember, and I would go back and see if I remember that. But it worked, because actually on my verbal portion, just the verbal portion of it, I almost got a perfect score. I think I got like a 740 or something on the verbal, just by taking the time that summer to learn 25 words every day. And I remember, because I used to hang out in the street corners in South Philly, so I would learn my words during the day, and then all my friends in the street corner at night, they'd be, uh-oh, here comes Mikey Nukes with those words again. He's going to hit us with the words, because I would try to practice the words so that, you know, if you use the word in context, then you learn
it. But you have to wait for the right situation to use one of those
I know, but words. That's why my friends didn't like it, because I would kind of fabricate situations and just kind of sort of ramrod the word in there so and hit him with 25 words every day. But and unfortunately, it didn't rub off on a lot of them. A lot of them just, you know.
Still hanging on the streets?
Probably.
Street corners?
Yeah, some of them are 6 feet under. But in any case. All right, well, listen, let's get back to the Freedom Lines here. That's good news for the SAT. And let's go first to Mike, who's listening in Arizona here. And he wants to weigh in with some of his thoughts on the 1062. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Real quick, we at our home have modified our diet to remove a lot of the red meat in the animals from our diet due to what we've seen over the last few years about these abuses. But and I think that's something we all should be doing to, you know, try to gain some power and legitimize these guys a little bit. But I called about 1062.
Hey, wait, before you do that, though, just before you do that, hold on 1 second, because there was an article, too, that I saw today, just now where we're mentioning about meat and trying to reduce the meat, just so that people get a little health care tip here. But what the recent research has indicated, if you're 50 years old or above, like in middle age right now, they're saying that it's important to reduce your consumption of meat and meat proteins, animal proteins, because they feel that if you can, at middle age, if you're eating those type of proteins, that you'll have a higher risk for cancer and, you know, some bad diseases. Versus if you're elderly, they say that then you should revert back more to animal protein as you're elderly, because that helps with your immune function and your body mass and, you know, things along those lines. So the thing today is, just so you know, middle age, no animal protein, elderly, animal protein.
They can't make up their mind, huh?
To me there, no. Dr. Mike. A lot of sense right. To me.
But all right, anyway, so go ahead.
Back to
1062.
1062, you know, I like to find out where these things originate from. Because I've never, down here in the Tucson area, I live in Vail, you know, we don't see this kind of stuff. It seems to me is a manufactured conflict piece, if you will. So I started looking into this and where this 1062 bill originated from, and it's called a group called Alliance Defending Freedom. And so then you ask, well, who are they? I look them up on the internet, and they're what they call a religious freedom restoration group, if you will. They're a legal ministry, which is a term I had never heard before. But again, and why is that relevant? It's because, you know, this group does nothing but target abortion issues. They target same-sex marriage and civil union issues. And it's one of these groups that have, you know, legislation in the can, if you will. They send out, they market, and a few states like Arizona picked it up and ran with it.
No, absolutely. Well, one of the biggest culprits out here, just so you know, is the Center for Arizona Policy, and that's run by Kathy Harrod, and they're always trying to put forward bills like this, these quote, under the guise of religious freedom. And in reality, it's quite the opposite. It's nothing about religious freedom. It's actually about religious persecution, that if you don't agree with sort of their evangelical Christian ways of looking at the world, then you're a heretic, and, you know, hell and fire and brimstone are going to fall down upon you.
Well, and you know, Eric Prince, who is the founder of the Blackwater Group, is a major founder of and a financier of this Alliance Defending Freedom. I mean, isn't it amazing how many groups that call themselves something freedom that are in there? That, but here's my spin on this. You know, as a business owner, you know, I pay taxes.
Right.
I promise you, with every ounce of my body, I'm tired of war. I hate war, right?
Sure.
So does this mean that as a business owner that I can choose to, you know, if they were to be successful with 1062, which they weren't, but does that mean that I get to say, you know, I don't want to pay my taxes?
Right. No.
Because I don't want to support the war machine?
Well, you could. You could say my religious views conflict with that. I don't agree with war, and that's not what my religious views dictate, and therefore I'm not going to be telling you. It's a slippery slope. And that's why I think ultimately the Supreme Court's going to shoot these things down. I hope they do, but if they don't, it's going to open up a Pandora's box of incredible confusion and discrimination and just really setting our society back, you know, hundreds of years. So listen, let me get running, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling down here from Vail in Tucson, Arizona. Appreciate it. Okay.
All
that's
right.
Mike calling from our home state here in Arizona, the wacky state where all of these crazy bills seem to originate. You know, we had the, what was it, 1070?
Yeah.
The Show Me Your Papers bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where a police officer or a law enforcement could actually stop somebody cold on the street, frisk you, and basically ask you whether or not you're a citizen. Prove that you're a United States citizen.
Yeah.
Just on a hunch.
1062 is like a solution for no problem.
Right.
I mean, you know, and then part of Kathy Herod's statement, when she made a statement after it was vetoed, she said, when the force of government compels one to speak or act contrary to their conscience, the government injures not only the dignity of the afflicted, but the dignity of our society as a whole. Now, I'm wondering what makes her think that the government's making them do something against their conscience.
No, what she wanted to do was to make the government to compel
exactly.
other people who are not of the faith to do as Kathy Herod wanted.
Against their conscience.
Right, exactly. So this is why I always call them conservatives. I mean, con artists. They call themselves conservatives, but they really should be called con artists, because just like the previous guy said, Mike, if they use the word freedom in a piece of legislation,
you know it's not about freedom.
You can almost be guaranteed that it's a bill attacking the freedom of everybody else. I mean, that's what they are. They're conservatives. If they say it's about liberty, I guarantee you it's about the opposite. If they say it's about individual freedom, I can guarantee you it's the opposite. That this is vintage classic conservatism. That's how they do things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, who's on vacation, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak to America's best fans. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program here. We're going to get to the Freedom Lines, and don't forget, at the top of the next hour, Eric, we're going to have another special guest, a regular of the show. Do you know who it is?
It's the news.
Wendell Potter.
Oh, Wendell Potter. I didn't
Wendell
know.
Potter will be joining us.
Totally unaware.
Yes, I'm going to be talking about Obamacare, what's in it for me, and also, you know, the deadline's coming up, March 31st.
Yes.
For signing up to participate in the healthcare exchange. And if you don't do it by then, by March 31st, then penalties could take effect if you don't get insurance even outside. You have to either sign up with the exchange by March 31st or get outside
insurance.
The exchange insurance. And if you don't, then it could be $95, I think, per person, or up to 1% of your income, whatever is greater. So if, say, you had $30,000 of income, 1% of that's $300. So it could be, you know, a little
bit
of a
hit. It's not very stiff fine, is it?
Well, it's not, but it's you know, yeah, but that's a fine nonetheless. You're calling for a stiffer fine, Eric?
No.
All right. Anyway, we'll talk to Wendell Potter and we'll get all the specifics on that. All right. In any case, let's get back to those freedom lines here. Let's see. First up in the queue, let's go to Armin. He's on the line from Florida. Armin, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. I always love your shows. It gives me perspectives that I don't sometimes think enough about.
Thank you, sir.
If I may, please, I'd like to talk about the pull yourself up by the bootstrap conservative Republicans in the House, and how they just passed a absolute socialized flood insurance program out of the House. It's got to go to the Senate. And I'd like to give you some statistics and facts on that, if I may, please, that proves that they're the party of hypocrisy. And I think they're starting to finally run out of suckers that believe their myth.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, if I may first, please, with your permission, because you are the host, you got the buttons, and you're the boss.
All righty.
What I think we should all be asking ourselves, and this is the question that I ask myself from day to day, because autonomy is not really the best right now. It's improving somewhat, but it's just not acceptable for the majority of the people, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And the question we should be asking ourselves is, I call it the $64 trillion question. And the $64 trillion question is, that's how much money since the end of the World War II we've spent on the war on poverty and the Cold War. And the $64 trillion question is, where is that money? That money is not circulating in our economy, because if it was circulating in our economy, we'd have so much prosperity that there'd be 10 people asking you to get off the mic and pay you 100 times more than you're making on the mic now to go somewhere else. And your assistant there and everybody else, it would be 10 jobs for every person instead of 10 people for every job.
Right. No, absolutely, Armin. I appreciate your perspective there, and we thank you for calling in today. And I want to get to some of the other callers, too, because I had Don on the line, who actually has been waiting a little longer than you, Armin, and he's from Seattle, Washington, so I didn't want him to wait too long there. Don, welcome to the table.
Hello.
Hey, Don. How are you?
Pretty good. You brought up mentioned this codeine pill with a slow release. Any
right.
Slow release pill can be deadly, because all you have to do is chew it.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, the manufacturers know how to formulate these things such that if you just chew it, it's not going to release all the medicine, you know, all at once. It has to get broken down in your body, and certain chemicals need to activate the medicine. And I don't think that's going to happen, Don. But in any case, you know, I do appreciate your call and, you know, you're concerned about that. But don't worry about it. If you take a long-acting pain medicine, Don, you're not going to die from it just by biting into the pill. So
I don't know anybody who chews their pills. They're not very tasty.
Well, no, they're not very tasty. I have a real hard time swallowing pills. I mean, can you swallow them?
I have no problem. Because when I was a kid, my mother would make me eat like 50 vitamins at breakfast every morning. So I learned how to take like, you know, 5-6 at a time.
Oh, do you take them? See, I only take one pill at a time. I would never swallow more than one pill at once.
Why?
I just get worried they're going to get stuck in my throat or my tonsils or something.
Just drink
like that.
Water with them and they don't.
I do, but then I just think, you know, I'm taking it, and then what if they
you're
get
stuck? You're a doctor,
and
you're worried about that?
I do, and then I figure there's nobody around to do the Heimlich, and then I start looking around like at high-top chairs, and if I have to self-Heimlich myself, and it's a very anxious moment for me anytime I think.
Oh, you're going to, like, bend over a chair and
yeah,
push down on your...
No, absolutely. Or jump from somewhere and try to, like, you know, hit my...
Have one of your beagles stop on you.
Oh, man, it's horrible, because I do have to take a cholesterol pill, but I also take some vitamin supplements just for my own edification, and it's something I dread every day.
Just drink a lot of water with it.
Well,
I
do.
It won't get stuck.
I do. So far, I haven't got it stuck, but it's going to happen eventually.
You were choking on water a little while ago.
I know.
So.
See that? See, that just goes to show you. So, all right, let's see. Let's go back to the Freedom Lines here. Let's see. Next up in the queue, who's been holding the longest? Let's go to Debbie in Washington, and she's listening on KBCS. Debbie, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, and thank you very, very much for talking about factory farms.
Sure.
I am also an animal lover. I have kept horses and dogs and cats, and I know quite a lot about them. And I wanted to say that it's not the thing to be a vegan to help oppose factory farms. In fact, do what I do and eat simply organic chicken. Mm-hmm. Which are chickens that are allowed to peck outside and walk around and eat grass and whatever, which are
free range, right?
For you anyway, and grass-fed beef and wild fish, and if you do that, you will encourage the people who raise those kinds of edibles,
right?
And that will, in fact, be a good antidote to the factory farms if more people would do that. And the other point about this is that stuff is much better for you.
No, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Debbie, you got the last word here in this hour, so thank you so much for calling in and offering up that piece of health advice to the listeners. Thank you.
I'm 79, and I eat a lot of protein, and it makes me feel more energetic.
Awesome. All right, thank you. We'll talk to you later.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom today. Tom is on vacation, and we have a special guest on. He's a regular on this program. His name is Wendell Potter, and he's the former health insurance executive at Cigna who turned whistleblower and also author of Deadly Spin and the new ebook out, Obamacare, What's in It for Me. So, Wendell, welcome back.
Dr. Mike, thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's great to have you. Actually, we were speaking about whistleblowers earlier. We had Paul Shapiro on, and he's with the Humane Society of the United States, and talking about some of the legislation, the ag gag bills that are out there in different states that would actually ban whistleblowers. They would not allow them to take pictures or photos or whatnot. So I thought you'd find that a little bit interesting, being a whistleblower yourself there.
Absolutely. I am very interested in that. And it's a very scary thing when you see proposals like that.
Yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of people who would have turned in Paul Revere, you know, for saying the British is coming.
You're exactly right.
But in any case, well, listen, Wendell, Obamacare, okay, we're now March, and it is March 5th today, I believe, and we have the deadline approaching March 31st. So give us a little snapshot of where we've been. I know we had a lot of the glitches and a lot of the problems with the infrastructure and the website and the portal, and where are we now, and where could we be in the end of the month and beyond?
Well, I think we're in pretty good shape right now in terms of the numbers of people who've been able to sign up and enroll in health plans on the exchanges, both the federal and state exchanges. As you well noted, we had some real problems at the very beginning of the open enrollment period at the 1st of October. But this was a brand new thing. No one had ever undertaken anything quite this big before in terms of selling health insurance or making it available in this kind of way. So glitches were inevitable. They were more serious than anyone could have imagined, I guess. But we've recovered, and more than 4 million people have signed up so far on the state exchanges. Several million more have signed up or are eligible for Medicaid in the states that are expanding. I heard or read, I think, the latest figure was about 9 million Medicaid-eligible individuals have been newly added or at least made eligible for Medicaid, which is a very good thing. So we are well on our way to meeting some of the big goals of healthcare reform, which is to reduce the number of uninsured Americans.
Yeah, and that's phenomenal if you really think about it, Wendell. I mean, just those numbers alone, 9 million potential new Medicaid recipients or insured, I should say, and also 4 million. That's 13 million people. I mean, wasn't the estimate roughly around 48 million that were uninsured in this country? I mean, 13 million out of, say, 45, that's almost a third of the people who were never covered, that are now covered.
It's true, and it's a significant dent in the number of uninsured, and I think we will continue to see that over time, and I would suspect that by the end of this month, we'll see that 4 million total will expand significantly. Whether we'll reach 7 million remains to be seen. That was the original hope, or at least the expectation by the Congressional Budget Office, and that was, again, pre-glitch, if you will, of the beginning of the open enrollment period. But I think we're well underway, and one of the things to keep in mind is that even though the open enrollment period for 2014 ends on March 31st, some people who have circumstances, there are people who can enroll after that. depending on their life circumstances. And also, there'll be another open enrollment for 2015 beginning in November. And this will be, ongoing. This is a marathon, not a sprint. We're at the very beginning of, a new way of getting health coverage in this country.
No, I think it's phenomenal. I mean, as a physician myself, I am just tickled pink to see this happening. It's a tragedy when you think that there's at least 45 million or was 45 million Americans who were not insured. And then correct me if I'm wrong, Wendell, but I think there's also a sizable amount of underinsured people who do have insurance, but with high deductibles and not having good coverage that they're considered underinsured, correct?
That's correct. And I think while the Affordable Care Act will not eliminate that problem, I think it's going to be limiting the number of people who are woefully underinsured. One of the problems before the Affordable Care Act was passed was that more and more people were enrolling in plans, sometimes unknowingly, sometimes because they had no other choice, enrolling in plans that had exceedingly high deductibles. I am familiar with people who have been enrolled in plans with family deductibles of $50,000 a year.
Wow.
Those are being outlawed. They are outlawed already by the Affordable Care Act.
Good.
So that kind of underinsurance will be a thing of the past. But some people will still be in plans with high deductibles. And for people who are of low income and even moderate income people, that can be problematic.
Talk to us a little bit, Wendell, about the subsidies, because I want the listeners to understand that this deadline is approaching March 31st, and as you mentioned, I think either October or November, it reopens, and you can get back on the exchanges. But talk about the subsidies, because if you do miss the deadline, then you will not be eligible for the subsidies, correct?
That's right, and that's a very important point, because if you do sign up for coverage on a federal or state exchange between now and the 31st, you are eligible, or you might be eligible for a subsidy or tax credit to help you pay for your coverage, which is a very important thing. It's one of the most important features of the Affordable Care Act, because while it's one thing to make insurance more affordable and having the exchanges and so that people can compare one health plan with another, it still would be unaffordable for a lot of people if the government didn't provide tax credits to help people pay the premiums. And most of the people who are uninsured are eligible for tax credits and subsidies. So it's very important that they take that into consideration, because they can get coverage and better value of coverage than they've been able to get in the past.
Right, and those subsidies are substantial, particularly if you're at the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder, correct, Wendell? I mean, do we have any kind of idea of what type of subsidy somebody, say, who made $30,000 or $25,000 to $30,000 a year might be eligible for?
Right. If you're at that level of income, you very possibly can enroll in a plan with a zero premium.
Wow.
There are many people who are eligible for tax credits that actually take care, the subsidies take care of their entire premium. They still may have some out-of-pocket obligations if they get sick or injured. But many people are eligible to get coverage at almost zero premium.
Wow. Now, what about the penalties, too? I mean, come March 31st, if you don't get your insurance through the exchange or through an outside vendor, you could face penalties on your 2014 tax return, correct?
That's right. It's not significant. Well it, I shouldn't say any money is significant. It's $90
sure.
and some change for
an adult.
2014 if you do not get coverage. If you remain uninsured, you will be subject to a penalty and have to pay it at tax time. It increases next year, so it's relatively low this year, but it will increase every year going forward.
Yeah, I was just looking at here. It looks like it's $95 per adult and $47.50 per child, or 1% of your household income, whichever is greater for 2014. But in 2015, it goes up to $325 per adult and 2% of your income. So
right, exactly. So beginning next year, there'll be even greater incentive than ever before and disincentives for remaining uninsured.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Listen, Wendell, you got time for one more quick segment?
I do.
Yeah, because what I want to do is I want to actually dovetail a little bit and talk about your book, your new ebook, Obamacare and What's in It for Me. I know we're talking today about the subsidies, but it's a very rich law, and it's a law that has lots of opportunities for different types of individuals, and I'm pretty sure that your book probably addresses that, correct?
Thank you very much. I'd love to do that.
So let's do that. Okay, we're here with Wendell Potter, and if you have any questions or insights, don't forget the Freedom Lines are open here on the Tom Hartman Program, 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Don't forget, March 31st is the deadline. Go out there and get on those exchanges. Get insured. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're here live with Wendell Potter, and we're going to be talking about his new ebook, Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. So, Wendell, welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
And thank you for being environmentally friendly with the ebook.
Yes, no trees. And the trees were damaged.
Exactly. So, so tell us about this. I'm looking at it right now online. I'm doing a little look inside here on I guess it's Amazon.com. So what's in it? What's in it for me? What's in it for you? What's in it for everyone?
Well, the thing is, and the reason I wrote the book is because so many people just either never knew or have forgotten why we had to have reform in the first place and what the law really does. The reality is that a lot of the benefits of the law are almost invisible to many people. They are there for us, but we just don't know it. And certainly all the headlines have been about the exchanges, the problems with exchanges, and more recently the number of people who are signing up for coverage on the federal and state exchanges. But there are many other important benefits that we all need to know about that will protect us in the future, and will in fact they're in effect right now, that in essence change the way that health insurance companies operate in this country to make them far more consumer friendly. And I wanted to make sure that people understood that. One of the great benefits of the law, for example, is it ends job lock in this country. No longer are we susceptible to losing our coverage if we get laid off or if we decide to take a job at a company that doesn't offer coverage. We can now get coverage through the exchanges, for example. We haven't been able to do that in the past. It also protects us if we get sick. The insurance companies can no longer drop us from coverage just because they don't want to pay our medical bills. And they can no longer refuse to sell us coverage because we've had a pre-existing condition, which is something that companies have done for years and years and years. And they can no longer charge women more than men, and they can no longer gouge older people as much as they have in the past. So there are many, many consumer protections that I felt was very important for people to be aware of in the law.
What about lifetime caps?
Another very important benefit of the law. In the past, before the law was passed, insurance companies sold policies that in many cases stopped paying for your medical bills after a certain limit was reached every year, or sometimes wouldn't cover anything more at all for the lifetime of your plan after reaching a certain limit. And those are no longer lawful. Insurance companies can no longer put a cap on how much they'll pay for our coverage, which is an important thing because obviously medical care is expensive and increasingly so. A hospital stay on average is more than $20,000, and a lot of the policies that had caps sometimes wouldn't even pay for a hospital stay. So that's another important benefit.
What about children? I know there's also in the Affordable Care Act, Wendell, that if you have a child and that child can remain on your health plan up until adulthood, right up to what, 25?
Up until age 26. And in fact, I wrote about that. The way I approached writing this book was to write about how it affects me and my wife and my two children, both who are young adults, as well as aunts and uncles and cousins of mine and people I know. All of us are stand-ins for the population at large. My own daughter was able to go back onto our policy.
Now, what's your daughter's name? Because I'm seeing Emily and Alex and
exactly.
Bobby.
Emily is
all right. And the young people without insurance. I got you.
Exactly. Emily was
chapter six, just for the listeners.
That's right. Yes. And Emily was kicked off of our policy, and she was able to go back onto it after the law was passed and stay on her plan until she turned 26. And that's a great benefit for almost any family, because all of our children are going to be hopefully aging into young adulthood, and in many cases they're just not able to get coverage that they can afford, or that at a company that offers coverage. So it's very important in particular for young adults.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Hey, Wendell, we're just running short of time, but maybe you could tell me, chapter 12 looks really interesting here too. It says myths, distortions, and outright lies. Maybe you can just give us a highlight from that chapter.
Well, it's hard to believe that many people still think that it's a government takeover of healthcare. It certainly is not. It keeps our insurance system in place. There are no death panels in the bill. A lot of people still seem to think that there are provisions in the law that enable the federal government to cut off benefits for Medicare beneficiaries at a certain point. That's just simply not true. So that there are a lot of myths that the e-book addresses and tries to put to rest.
Now, if people want to check out the e-book, Wendell, what would they need to do? Just go to Amazon? Is that who covers it? Or
you can go to Amazon. You can go to iTunes. You can go to BarnesandNoble.com. Any place that sells electronic books, you can find it. And it's at a very good price. It's less than
$3. I'm looking at Kindle edition, $251.
That's exactly right. I want it to be very affordable.
Yeah, well, yeah, that definitely. This is this might be even more affordable than the Affordable Care Act.
It can, and look at it this way, it can certainly save you a lot of money if you read it.
No, absolutely. Hey, one last thing. What about Medicare preventive services? Because I'm a geriatric physician. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's a very, and I do mention that as well too. For the first time, Medicare does pay for preventive care. Before the Affordable Care Act, it did not. So it's a very important benefit, and also it closes the donut hole in the prescription drug benefit. So people are getting more coverage for their prescription drugs than before too.
Tell people what that donut hole is.
And the donut hole in the prescription drug benefit was created when the law was passed. You get coverage for a while. And after you fill a certain number of prescriptions and they reach a certain amount, you don't get any coverage until you've spent quite a bit of money out of your own pocket.
Right.
That gap is called the donut hole.
Wow.
And it's being closed. It'll be closed completely in the next few years. But every year it's being closed a bit more. And already senior citizens have saved many millions of dollars that they otherwise would have had to spend out of their own pocket.
No doubt about it. Well, listen, Wendell, as always, it's a pleasure to speak to you. Keep up the good work and spreading the good word. And in particular, Obamacare, What's in It for Me? It's an e-book, a digital book. You can get it for $2.51 on Kindle. Go to Amazon.com, and it's probably worth the investment. So, Wendell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. Take care now.
Okay, and we'll be back with your calls. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, Phoenix, Arizona, this is the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to Freedom Express, chugging along here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Eric, we're going to be bareback for the remaining two sections here, or sessions?
Segments.
Segments, that's
You're
it.
In radio, Mike. You
yes.
should know that.
Exactly. I'm so used to studying, I think of things in sections, you know, section one, section two. But in any case, yes, so let me give you a number of that Freedom Line, 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Anything you guys want to talk about is fair game. So let's get right to it. Let's see. First up in the queue, who's been holding the longest, is Jim, listening on Free Speech TV from Longtree, Colorado. Jim, welcome on board.
Yeah, I was wondering if you heard about the fast diet.
The fast. Give me a little hint.
Okay, Dr. Michael Mosley, what he found out, he did a PBS show. He does BBC shows for England. Mm-hmm. But he came over. He was kind of desperate. And he found research that they were doing, also called a 5-2 diet. And they were doing it on mice. And he found out that when they put them on the 5-2 diet, that they lived 30% longer. Well, let me start over. They took mice that died young and got Alzheimer's young. When they put them on a diet, they lived 30% longer, and the Alzheimer's only kicked in at the end. they think that you actually grow brain cells on this diet.
Interesting.
And
now what's
I went
the
on
five?
A diet. I was desperate.
Uh-huh.
I remember after 4 months of going to the gym, 5-6 days a week with the wife, she wasn't losing anything. I said, that's enough. It's over. I caught the last 15 minutes of the show. I said, I start Monday. I do it Monday and Thursday so you can do them together. I was a high of 220, dropped down to 175. I lost 30 pounds in the first 2 months. And Tom Hartman's gone on it.
Uh-huh.
Asking
Tom,
about it.
Tom's lost the weight. I've seen
him on that diet that day. And he said his blood pressure went from 180 down to normal. Mine was 150. I had one low reading, 105. But I had one guy on this diet. Saw him after 6 weeks. And he was,
so what does 5-2 mean? Is it like it?
He lost
is
37
it,
pounds. It chopped his stomach in half. On this diet, you actually lose the weight on the stomach. And it's kind of amazing where usually, you know, you lose it in spots you don't care about.
Okay, I got you. So it's 5 days on, 2 days off. Is that correct?
Unless you're a woman. But
right.
But no, there's a controversy going on here that they won't talk about. That I was wondering why would, you know, big business fight against this diet? Because in America, they've been attacking this diet. In Europe, they've been raving about it. That should tell you everything.
Right. Well, I got to do a little research on it just because I'm not really familiar about it. But if Tom has used it and Tom recommends it, Tom's an incredibly bright, intelligent individual, and he does his homework and his research. So I'm sure there's some very beneficial aspects to it. But listen, I appreciate it. I got some homework to do tonight. So thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay. Let's get back to the Freedom Lines there. The FAST, F-A-S-T. See, when I think of FAST, that's a scale that we use for dementia to determine whether or not how demented somebody is, like a functional assessment screening test. And it goes from, you know, 6-something to 7A, B, C, D, E. And, you know, depending on what your level is in the FAST score, if you have, like, say, 7E, that's, like, really bad. You might have a few months left to live.
How do you determine that?
Oh, you have to do all types of tests. Are they incontinent? Can they speak more than 5 words in a certain sentence? Can they smile? Can they hold their head up? Can they sit erect without any, you know, help? There's all different ways to quantify, and then you get a score for the patient. And then depending what your FAST score is.
How do I fare?
You're fine. I don't think you're imminent quite yet. All right, let's get back to the Freedom Lines here. Let's see. Next up in the queue is Joe calling from Marshall, North Carolina. He wants to give me a little advice, Eric, on how to swallow pills.
All right.
There you go.
Yeah, I was just listening to that about the 5-2 diet.
Yes.
And I think that's out of a week, maybe 5 days you eat and 2 you don't?
No, I don't know if it's that. I think it's 5 days you kind of eat normally, and then I'm understanding
okay.
2 days,
okay,
then you
like
eat
that.
Really low calories, like,
exactly.
You know, 500 or
but
600 calories in a
vitamins,
day.
Vitamins? And what you were saying about taking vitamins or pills?
Yeah, the pills, swallowing pills. Yeah, I don't like swallowing pills.
I don't either, and I can totally relate because I did choke on a small hard pill, vitamin,
mm-hmm.
and I was lucky that it popped up 20 minutes later. And
wow.
So I was going to give you a hint of what I do now that really helps me because
mm-hmm.
I need my vitamins. So what I do is I chop up the hard ones and I put them in a juicer.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm making a green drink, I have it in my – I have those with it, and I add it to my V8, spicy V8, and you can't even taste them.
Right. Okay.
And I just was doing that, actually, when you came on the show and started talking about this.
Wow. How ironic, right?
Yeah, I know. And then the gel caps I can just put into a blender with like a good blender drink.
Right, right.
And then, of course, you can buy those gummy chewables too now.
Yeah, actually, I've tried those gummy chewables, and they're actually pretty good. Have you tried those, Eric? Like those gummy bears, but they're vitamins?
No, I have not.
Yeah, they are actually pretty good. A friend of mine had that up in upstate Arizona. So, all right, well, listen, Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate the advice to the doctor here, and I just might follow it.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye. You know, one thing I do, Eric, is that I like vitamin C, too. I take about 500 milligrams of vitamin C per day, and rather than the pill.
Those are chewables.
Yeah, I get the chewables, yeah. And they're actually a little tasty, too.
Yeah, I don't mind those.
Yeah, so those are not so bad. All right, let's get back. Let's see. Let's go next to who's holding the longest. I always like to be fair here. Let's go to Donald. He's calling from Chicago, Illinois, listening on WCPT. And, Donald, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, hi, Doc. You know, I got a call from my sister. She watches MSNBC, and she's going out of her mind with this. She heard on MSNBC that the Republicans, the GOP, has discovered some kind of a new thing that can replace Obamacare, and they're putting it on hold, and they're repealing it for the 50th time, and they're going to allow everybody to stay on it until 2016, and in 2016 it's going to get repealed. Have you heard anything about this? Because I'm going nuts, too.
No. Well, what are they saying? How are they going to repeal it? I mean, first of all, you have to have the votes in Congress. And then secondly, even if you had the votes in Congress, you have to have the executive officer in charge, because if it's another Democrat, they're clearly going to veto it. So I'm not really quite sure what machinations or tricks they're talking about to repeal it.
Yeah, well, because she was really frantic about it, and I thought maybe you might know something about it. I mean, at least I always thought there's no way they can repeal this here, that it's the law, you know, and I don't know.
They can't repeal it. Look, right now they can't. There's no way with Obama in office, and you could just bank on it, until 2016, it's definitely the law of the land. Now, that being said, laws can be repealed if you get the majority necessary in Congress, and if you also have a friendly president. So if they wanted to repeal this law in 2016 and they had, you know, 50% plus one senators and 50% plus one congressmen and women, then guess what? And then if you have a Republican president, yeah, they could repeal it. But until 2016, it ain't going to happen, period.
Well, then I have a funny feeling that's what they were talking about. She misconstrued everything. They probably said they must be so, they must be pretty, they must be so sure of themselves that they are going to win in 2016. That I find very,
They were pretty sure of themselves in 2012, and they were sure of themselves in 2008, and it didn't pan out. And guess what? If they keep alienating people, like, you know, the gay community and minorities and whatnot, they're going to ostracize themselves and become just basically a regional party, the Republican Party. They need to start opening up that tent and being more for true liberty and more for true freedom. And they obviously are not. They're not thinking that way right now, and until they get their head out of the sands or out of you know where, they're going to have a tough time. So listen, Donald, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's Donald calling in from Chicago, opening up another Freedom Line here live on the Tom Hartman program. Let's go next to Carol, who had a question for Wendell, but maybe I might be able to field it. She's calling in from Illinois as well, Bloomington. Carol, welcome.
Thank you. Last November, I entered my husband into the hospital, and we were informed that because of affordable care, our family doctors, cardiologists, MDs, pulmonologists, urologists, would not be coming into the hospital to take care of him because the hospital maintains its own staff of medical doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who would be servicing him while he was in the hospital.
Right.
Is this true?
Well, look, hospitals have bylaws, okay? And in order for a doctor to go into a hospital, you have to have staff privileges. And those staff privileges are conferred to you by the actual hospital. And the hospital, you have to send in an application, they have to do a background check, and they have other rules and regulations. But it really is up to the hospital who they accept on staff or not. So it's probably not that far-fetched if the hospital's saying, look, we got our own staff physicians. But, you know, it's usually not a good policy for a hospital if you have a regular doctor or your primary doctor or a specialist who's willing to go there and conduct a procedure or take care of you. They generally are usually open to that. But listen, Carol, I got to run, so I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Okay, that's Carol here. Well, listen, we're going to come up with the final segment, so we still got Tom, Tim, Mary, another Tom, Deirdre, lots of people holding on. I'll get to all your calls as best I can when we return for the conclusion of this special edition of the Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back, Eric. Here we are, the final segment for today. I did a little quick research on the internet about this diet, this fast.
Yes.
So essentially that's what it is. It's a fast. You do 5 days of normal eating and 2 days you fast. But you don't fast where you have no calories.
You just eat very little.
About 500 to 600 calories is roughly the estimate is what they're looking at. So, and you're supposed to do that on two non-consecutive days. So you could eat regularly for 3 days and then fast and take the day off. You go back.
So like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you eat, and then Tuesday.
Well, it's only two non-consecutive days. So for 5 days, you can eat regular.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. So, and then those two other days just have to be non-consecutive, and you have to eat about 500 to 600 calories. And obviously, there's some caveats that if you're a pregnant woman or if you're a diabetic, et cetera, you don't want to reduce your calories too much because there could be adverse effects. But interestingly enough, I've probably inadvertently been doing like a pseudo fast for the last several years because, as you remember, I was a little heavier back in the day, as were you.
As was I.
You've lost weight as well.
Yeah, but I didn't diet. I was on a forced diet.
Well, you ended up in the hospital undergoing the knife and surgery. I mean, not bariatric surgery. You actually had something else. But in any case, I started cutting my calories, and there were times when I definitely remember going around 600 calories a day, and my wife thought I was insane. She's like, you know, she called me manorexic, is what she said. That was a new term, manorexic. But
I've heard that.
Yeah, but I felt fine though because I trained my body, you know, over time to not really have that hunger pain and, you know, wanting to sort of just go out there and pig out on something. So I might have done it maybe a few more days than two out of the seven, though, early on. But I would say that even today, there's probably about 2 or 3 days out of the week where I – like today, I woke up, I took my vitamins, and I had a bowl of Chobani yogurt with some blueberries and some strawberries. And then I've had water for the rest of the day. That's all I've had today. So
yeah, water fills you up pretty good.
Yeah, but I don't feel that hungry right now. I mean, I'm getting hungry, though.
I'm hungry.
Although I did text my wife and say, I want some meatballs and rigatoni tonight. So
that, after talking about the animals.
Yeah, that I feel bad now. But that would blow the fast. But I'm not just craving food right now. I mean, you saw I keep drinking this water throughout the show, and it keeps me well hydrated. It distends the stomach. You don't have the hunger, you know,
pangs
that you would expect from that. So yeah, I kind of get it. I mean, it's look, you know, the bottom line is it's calorie reduction. If you take in less calories
right.
and burn more, I don't care what you call the diet, you're going to lose weight.
Right. You just don't overeat. That's the whole thing.
I mean,
you know?
Bottom line is you'll lose weight. So there's no question about it. All right, listen, let's get back to the Freedom Lines, 1-866-987-THOM. Get to the final callers for the day. Let's go first to, let's see here, Deirdre. Deirdre calling from Congress, Arizona, and she has some insight about Congress. So, Deirdre, welcome.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to tell you, for the last 2 years, Congress has been voting to repeal the Obamacare. Today was the 50th time.
Wow.
Knowing that it will not go through the Senate, but they still do it, and it costs over $1 million every time they do this.
I know. What a waste of money, right?
What a waste of money. So that's what they're doing, is wasting money. And yes, MSNBC is right. But I watched C-SPAN 1 and 2. That's the Congress and the Senate. And you could watch that and find out all you need to know on the debates, on the votes, on the amendments, and what they're doing.
All right. Sounds good, Deirdre. Thank you for calling in from Congress, Arizona. Where is Congress again? I know.
It's north of Phoenix.
South of Prescott?
Wickenburg, just north of Wickenburg, between Yarnell and Wickenburg.
All right, gotcha. All right, thank you, Deirdre.
Thanks, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Can you believe how much money they waste doing things like that?
I know. I mean, she's right. It's tens of millions of dollars that have been wasted just by trying to repeal something that you know it's not going to happen.
It's futile, and you still do it.
Right, and these are the ones.
Isn't that what insanity is, doing the same thing over and over again with the same result?
Yeah, and expecting a different result, yeah. No, absolutely. And the bottom line is it's a waste of money. And these are the ones, Eric, who call themselves what? Fiscal conservatives. We're the one who wants to get rid of the government waste, you know, all the excess. Well, if you're just squandering like $50 million, like it's nothing, and you know that, you know, say you got it passed in the House, you know, in the Senate, do you think Obama's going to say, all right, you got me. I'm going to repeal my signature
right.
legislation that's going to define my legacy and going to change America for the better. It's just not going to happen. All right, let's get back to some more callers here. Let's go next to Tom. He's calling from Tucson, Arizona. I got a lot of Arizonans calling today. Tom, welcome.
Well, Obamacare will save money. It's a godsend.
I agree it's a godsend. I think it's a wonderful law, and I am very happy that it was passed. And I think, you know, many people – look, here's the bottom line. They keep talking about – I'll find out what they're talking about with this MSNBC and the repeal malarkey. But it's not going to happen because most of the major provisions are coming in this year, in 2014. And once people start seeing the benefits of these major provisions that are going to all roll in to full force this year – the Republicans are going to have a very tough time 2 years from now trying to take away what people are now going to be accustomed to and used to. Look, it's just like Medicare. When Medicare first started out, you know, there was a lot of this crap about, hey, it's going to be communism and it's a government takeover of health care and the public doesn't want it. Well, slowly but surely, as it took root, the Americans were like, hey, this is awesome. You know, we love this concept of Medicare and health care for the elderly and the disabled. And now every time the Republicans try to talk about, you know, ending Medicare as we know it or privatizing Medicare, obviously they're met with fierce opposition. The same thing is going to happen with the Affordable Care Act, that each year, each day that goes by, each day that goes by, each year that goes by, the public is going to say, you know what, this is actually a well thought out law. This is something that benefits me, it benefits my family, my friends, my loved ones, and the Republicans are going to have an incredibly difficult time repealing it 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 10 years from now. So the Republicans realize that as each minute passes, as each day goes by, if they can't repeal this thing, they know there's going to be practically no hope whatsoever of repealing it sometime later on. So listen, I appreciate that call, Tom. Thank you so much. And a special thanks to all of Tom's staff, everybody from Shane to Danielle to Sean to Jim Javinsky. We really appreciate the opportunity to be on the air and look forward to being back in the future. Obviously, acts of God and weather not preempting the program. So take care, as Tom always says. Democracy is a participatory sport. So tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.